for the invitation. Thanks for inviting me, Mike. Thank you all for coming at the end of what I'm sure has been a very long semester. If it was anything like my semester, probably completely exhausted. So I've written this paper, which is completely full of tongue twisters, so do forgive me if it's sort of stumbling about all over the place. It sort of ended up having, people were asking me, oh, what are you going to talk about when you go to Bristol? And I said, well, I seem to be sort of doing everything I've ever thought about nature for the last 10 years. So that's why the title is so convoluted. But hopefully I'll manage to say something of interest to all of you at one stage or another. I have assumed a bit of knowledge of phenomenology, I think. So I'm very happy to explain any bits that are not clear afterwards, and any sort of basic or more advanced questions about what on earth I'm talking about when I'm talking about phenomenology are very welcome. Okay, so I'll get on with it. So many philosophers in the continental tradition have recently turned away from phenomenology, developing arguments that attempt to demonstrate the inherent limits of phenomenology, or to show that the very idea of phenomenology is inherently problematic. And one of the key reasons that they've made this move away from phenomenology is because of the problem that Ted Toadvine has recently described as the inherent paradox of any phenomenology of nature. So this is the first quote on your handout. To the extent that phenomenology starts with experience, we seem constrained at the outset to reduce nature to the range of our perceptual faculties, to frame it in terms of our spatial and temporal scale, and to encounter it in anthropomorphic terms, that is, to humanize it. So that's certainly a line of thought that motivates phenomenology towards a radical reflection on its own possibility. And in the rest of his book, Toadvine spends quite a lot of time showing us that Merleau-Ponty was driven to repeatedly rethink the idea of what it means to start with experience in order to make a space for reflection on what our understanding of nature could be if we start with experience, as phenomenology is supposed to do. It seems to me that in the end, you could reverse this line of thought that a phenomenology is unable to deal with nature because it always correlates the experience of the subject with the world that the subject is experiencing. You could reverse that line of thought and suggest that the real paradox is with a philosophy that attempts to think about nature without starting with experience in any sense whatsoever. Seems to me that the real paradox would be that kind of approach to nature. So in what follows, I want to explore a number of ways in which nature is experienced as extra-experiential. So what all of these phenomenological possibilities have in common is that nature as extra-experiential is not experienced as such, but comes in some way to be in itself in the light of experience. So experience doesn't simply discover what is independent of itself in the light of its own limits, but experience shows nature to be independent and preserves it in its independence. So I've come up with this term, and it's not an entirely ideal term, but I haven't been able to think of a better one so far. The extra experiential inexperience, because it's meant to cover the sort of two contrasting possibilities that I'm going to talk about in the rest of the talk, what I call hyper-phenomenal and hypo-phenomenal. And I couldn't really think of a better term to cover both of those as yet, but maybe you could help me out there if you can think of one. So we're talking about nature as extra-experiential in experience. Two misunderstandings should be guarded against here. What's extra-experiential, as I understand it, is neither strictly speaking transcendent nor transcendental. So nature does not maintain itself utterly beyond experience. And to that extent, I agree with Husserl, a founder of phenomenology, who says that pure transcendence is incomprehensible to phenomenology. But there are ways in which experience transcends itself, and what is experience transcends our experiencing. Something that's been of a special interest in various kind of theological terms in phenomenology in recent years. Thinking about the way that experience transcends itself and we experience the way that something is transcended in our experience. So we're not talking about something purely transcendent, but we're not talking about something strictly speaking transcendental either, when transcendental means an investigation into the conditions of our experience, something that's prior to or before our experience. If those conditions are absolutely prior to our experience and don't, in a sense, fall into our experience or show up in our experience at all, then they're going to be incomprehensible to phenomenology as well. But it seems to me that we can hold on to an idea of conditions of experience or the a priori in experience, which in a sense is still what I'd like to call exposed to experience, or at least shows up in experience in some way. So again, the idea is that we're talking about the extra experiential in experience. Okay, so what I've done in the rest of the paper is to sketch out several ways in which I hope we can fill out this idea of the extra experiential in experience. That's how I think we should be thinking about nature. And I've sort of set out various possibilities, so that's what I'm going to do in the rest of the paper. So phenomenology thinks about nature in terms of the ways that phenomena come to appear or manifest. So nature is the coming to appearance of phenomena, or rather, as I'm putting it, something extra experiential in experience of phenomena. In that case, I identify two fundamental strategies that phenomenologists can use for thinking about this extra experiential. The first is nature thought as hyper-phenomenal, and the second, nature thought as hypophenomenal. Hyperphenomenality refers to everything in the coming to appearance of phenomena that's a kind of overflow or excess in experience. So nature here is found in experience, but is not reduced to what is within the scope of human powers, since it appears as precisely what is excessive to them. Okay, and then on the other hand, you've got hypophenomenality, which is the other side of that extra experiential in experience. Nature as that which is less than what is normally present, a kind of dearth or poverty in the appearance of phenomena. So my claim isn't that one of these two is the proper experience of nature, but that both of them feed into our understanding of nature, and that we need to take both of them into account in order to have a fully rounded phenomenology of nature. So this difference that I've identified between hyperphenomenality and hypophenomenality is the focus of this analysis. But there's another difference which I bring into play just to complicate matters even further. The ontological difference, what Heidegger calls ontological difference, the difference between being and beings, which clearly cuts across this distinction that I've made between the hyper and hypophenomenality. And that leaves us with this kind of fourfold structure, which I've sort of put in this little diagram, which may or may not be helpful for you to work out what's going on. So if we cross the ontological difference with this difference that I've identified between hypo and hyperphenomenality, then you get kind of four corners of the world. Nature thought of as a hyperphenomenal world, as a saturated phenomena which appear within that world. Thirdly, as a hypophenomenal world, and finally as hypophenomena. So I've called these plenitude, saturated phenomena, withdrawal, and mesh. So don't worry if that doesn't all sort of make sense at the moment, because hopefully it will make a bit more sense when I've gone through each of those possibilities in a bit more detail. Okay, so just a couple more caveats before I get into the four regions of nature that I've identified. So the differentiation of hyperphenomenality and hypophenomenality isn't meant to be a revival of what Merleau-Ponty calls Sartre's Manichaean polarization of plenitude and nothingness. If you've come across Sartre, you'll remember that it's all about being and nothingness. Plenitude and nothingness, and their irreconcilable conflict. That's something that Merleau-Ponty has a big problem with, and I agree with him. My suggestion is that hyperphenomenality and hypophenomenality are aspects of all manifestation, but they both come together to make up the nature of phenomena, or what I'm calling extra-experiential inexperience. So unlike Sartre, I make no suggestion that hypophenomenality comes from the side of consciousness and hyperphenomenality comes from the side of the world. Neither does hypophenomenality as such have any necessary connection with negation or negativity. And finally, this hyperphenomenality and hypophenomenality are not necessarily polarized or in any kind of struggle in the way that Merleau-Ponty argues is a problematic feature of Sartre's understanding of the struggle between being and nothingness. Okay, so I'm going to get to the four regions that you can see on your diagram. In the course of the following, I'm drawing on various phenomenologists. So I've already spoken a little bit about Sartre and Merleau-Ponty. They're not going to feature very heavily, actually. So I thought I'd just get them all out of the way. most of what I'm thinking about here is sort of an attempt to get to grips with some of the later Heidegger, especially the first bit. I'm going to be talking about some of Heidegger's work on Hölderlin's poetry. And I'm also drawing on a couple of other phenomenologists, which I'll make clear as I go along. One other contemporary ecological thinker, who I suppose is not strictly speaking a philosopher, although I don't really care either way, the literary scholar Timothy Morton, is the inspiration for my use of the term mesh, which I'm going to talk about at the end of the paper. You might have come across Morton's work, which I think is very interesting. He wrote a book a while back called Ecology Without Nature. His latest one is the Ecological Thought. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that last one at the end of this talk, the Ecological Thought. And this notion of mesh, and the idea is, well, Morton's thought is that mesh is a kind of way of thinking what he calls the ecological thought. He says the ecological thought is basically the thought that everything is connected. That's what he says, the ecological thought, is that everything is connected. We need to think that in a particular kind of way, and he devises this term, the mesh, to think about it, whereby in the mesh, gaps and spaces are just as important, if not more important, than connections and relations. So that's where we're sort of heading towards, thinking about this notion of the mesh. And my thought is that hopefully I'm going to make it a little bit more philosophically precise, but he might have some problems with that when I tell him about it, so we'll see. Okay, so that's the intro. Right, so the first of these four aspects of experience, where I think we can identify something extra experiential in our experience, that I'm calling plenitude or a hyper-phenomenal world. Okay, so the first possibility of seeing nature as extra experiential is plenitude, a kind of presence that pervades everything that we experience, without manifesting itself as a being or a property or a set of relations. So this is the sense of nature that Heidegger famously finds in his reading of Hölderlin's poem, As When on Holiday. So this is on your handout as well, I think. Wonderful is the omnipresence of nature. She can never be found somewhere in the midst of the real, like one more isolated actual thing. The all-present is also never the result of combining isolated real things. Even the totality of what is real is at most the consequence of the all-present. The all-present escapes explanation on the basis of what is real. The all-present cannot even be indicated by something real. So, as is well known, at least by people that I hang out with, Heidegger goes on to argue that the word nature, as it appears in this poem, retains and retrieves some deep connections with the sense of the word phusis in Greek, the Greek word for nature. So he's saying that in this poem, when Hölderlin says nature, he has a lot of the sense of the Greek word phusis packed into it, if you like. This nature withdraws, he says, from the production of things to allow for that production to take place. And yet it passes through everything in its presence. So again, he says it names the beautiful as the coincidence of captivation and rapture. And he points us towards the Latin roots of the word nature, meaning beginning, and retaining a connection with the Greek word phusis, from phuein, which means to grow. So Heidegger goes on to talk about all of those aspects of the use of nature in this poem, but he also argues that Hölderlin doesn't manage to fully fathom everything that the Greeks meant by phusis, but at the same time, being Heidegger, he sort of then suggests, well, probably the Greeks didn't fully fathom all of the sense of their own word, and probably Heidegger's not going to manage to do it entirely either. So there's some missing aspects to the understanding of nature as Heidegger reads it in this poem, and I'm going to talk about a few of those a bit later in the paper. But before we do that, here's some of the sort of positive lessons that Heidegger draws from his reading of this poem. Two thoughts I think should motivate us to think that nature thought of in this way as the holy all-present is still relevant today for people like me who are working in this field of ecological phenomenology. Firstly, all metaphysics of presence and of plenitude that appears in Hölderlin's understanding of the all-present can be understood, as I read Heidegger talking about it, as a forerunner of today's technological disclosure of nature, in which even the most varied and hidden undiscovered capacities of things are already theoretically on the radar in a kind of amorphous mass of energy in a standing reserve. So as I'm reading Heidegger here, he suggests that there is some kind of connection between thinking of nature in this way and the way that nature has come to be thought of and treated in technological modernity. And he points this out as part of Hölderlin's poem, that nature can indeed in this way be misconstrued as a servant. So when nature is misconstrued in that way, each thing is no more than what it accomplishes. And there's a tension here, I think, between Heidegger's understanding of the holy as in some way dissolving all things into this mass of amorphous energy, which can be used for anything that we want it to be used for, and what he sees as, I think, Herzl's intention to point us towards a holy which, whilst showing us that everything is connected in some way, nevertheless manages to preserve each thing in its individuality. I suppose connected to that, the second reason why I think this reading of a poem, of Herzl's poem by Heidegger, is still quite interesting, is that it connects up with what Tim Morton calls the ecological thought, the ecological thought that everything is connected. So the holy, or the all-present, as Heidegger reads it, is a sense of nature which kind of skirts around some of the difficulties that Tim Morton has. So Tim Morton wrote this book, Ecology Without Nature, and he has some interesting and important arguments as to why the very idea of nature is often very problematic. But it seems that, the reasons mainly revolve around the thought that if we think of nature as something separate to us, it involves a kind of self-alienation and a positing of something that's completely outside of us. He thinks that's not really conducive to a proper sort of ecological attitude. So he suggests that perhaps we rethink the very idea of using the term nature when we're thinking ecologically. But when Heidegger's talking about nature in this way and thinking about it in this poem, it seems that he kind of skirts around all of those issues, because he's talking about nature as the all-present, which is not only the connectedness of all things, which is what Tim Morton wants us to think, but it's something that, Heidegger says, allows for all connectedness to come about in the first place, and preserves things from a kind of dissolution into an amorphous mass of energy. So this is what Heidegger again writes about the poem. I should have given you a copy of this poem, really. Oh well, never mind. Any individual actuality in all connections is possible only if, before all else, nature grants the open, within which immortals and mortals and all things are able to encounter each other. The open mediates the connections between all actual things. These latter are constituted only because of such mediation and are therefore mediated. So, I suppose, as a kind of important extension of Tim Morton's idea that the core of ecological thinking is that everything is connected, is this thought that Heidegger's drawing out of this poem, which is there's a sense of nature which is the open space in which things can become connected in the first place. And that in a sense, and I think this adds to what Morton is saying, it's not just that everything is connected, it's that everything can become connected in multiple ways. So it's not already connected before our experience has taken place in any absolute sense. But nature is that which allows things to become connected, and in becoming connected, retain their singularity, their individuality. Or even, maybe even better than retain it, actually, their singularity and their individuality is a function of the ways that they can become connected with everything else. Okay, so that's plenitude, or the all-present. What I'm suggesting Heidegger sort of calls the being, a certain way of thinking being, what allows anything to be, And if we shift the focus slightly towards being, so the things that can appear within such a world, I'm going to call that saturated phenomena. So the granting of individual things in their connectedness brings up the second possibility of thinking about nature in this way. And I borrowed this term, saturated phenomenon, from the thinker Jean-Luc Marion, to refer to a kind of singular hyper-phenomenon, so something that appears that's in excess of everyday or ordinary experience. For Marion, calling such phenomena objects, or even calling them beings, is problematic, because the very idea that he's trying to get at is that a saturated phenomenon is so absolutely given to us in its phenomenality that it overflows or is in excess of all intentionality or ways in which the subject directs itself towards the phenomenon. Now, there's a environmental thinker who I think is very interesting on this, Bruce Boltz, who's argued that Marion's notion of saturated phenomena can be very fruitful when it's employed to try to move us away from a notion of nature as something completely self-subsistent and a fully intelligible system. He thinks that we can deploy Marion's notion to give us what he calls the other side of nature, or the givenness of phenomena. And one of the important points that Boltz emphasises is that what Marion's talking about here is not simply the identification of certain extraordinary phenomena. So Marion himself spends a lot of time arguing that we're not talking about identifying particular extraordinary things. What we're talking about is trying to identify certain kinds of exemplary or iconic phenomena which show the basic kind of givenness that is apparent in all phenomena. So it's not that we find saturated phenomena and then we say, oh, look, these are an extremely special bunch of phenomena, but in finding them, they become iconic or exemplary of a possibility of excess in givenness that we could find in all phenomena. So Marion fleshes this out in various ways, which I won't go into. He uses the Kantian table of categories to suggest that there could be an excess of phenomenality in various ways that sort of hook up with the Kantian table of categories. And I'm not really sure what I think about this strategy. I think it's a bit problematic, really. But I haven't really thought out exactly why. So I'm going to leave that to one side for the moment and just think a little bit about some things that we find sort of in more familiar thinking about nature or thinking about ecology, where this idea of saturated phenomenon might be helpful. So I'm going to concentrate on animality or animals and, well, living beings more generally. And I think we could use this notion of saturated phenomena to approach this idea from two different directions. From, well, what roughly speaking you might call the outside or from the inside. So experience of animals or experience of how animals relate to the world around them. So to take it from the outside, our own experience of animals, I think that we might use this notion of saturated phenomena quite helpfully to rethink the idea of what ecologists call charismatic megafauna. So these things, charismatic megafauna, they're large, well-known animals, frequently humanized, like pandas, and polar bears and koalas and deer and eagles and the RSPB nice little AVA set. Have you seen that? It's my favourite. Such charismatic megafauna are often seen to be the kind of bogeymen of environmentalists and ecologists, because those ecologists argue that they take the focus away from many other deserving species and focus them on isolated species, often top predators, that are thought to be charismatic in some way. And that distracts us not only from thinking about the importance of some other species, but also from thinking more ecologically about the importance of the interconnectedness of all things, and the integrated dynamic way in which ecosystems and life cycles and food webs exist. I think that's true as far as it goes, but there's no doubt that charismatic megafauna do play an important role in many of our experiences of nature. And I think that we could use this idea of saturated phenomena or iconic phenomenality to help us see why that might be the case. And we might provide some further justification for thinking about a connection between Marion's notion of saturated phenomena and charismatic megafauna by recalling that before, in the 1950s, people decided that charismatic meant possessing personal charm. It had a Greek root in the word charisma, which means a favour or divine gift, from charis, which means apparently grace or beauty or kindness. So I'm going to connect this idea of saturated phenomena to that kind of notion of charismatic. And to do that, I have a quick look at this passage from Aldo Leopold, a famous ecologist, where he speaks about charismatic megafauna in the following way. The physics of beauty is one department of natural science still in the Dark Ages. Not even the manipulators of bent space have tried to solve its equations. Everyone knows, for example, that the autumn landscape of the northern woods is the land, plus a red maple, plus a ruffed grouse. In terms of conventional physics, the grouse represents only a millionth of the mass or the energy of an acre. But subtract the grouse, and the whole thing is dead. An enormous amount of some kind of motive power has been lost. So I think there's quite a lot of interesting stuff going on in that passage. So I'll point to a couple of the things that I find particularly interesting. Firstly, he points us towards a red maple and a ruffed grouse. Now that could mean any red maple or any ruffed grouse that you care to find, but it clearly also means something like the singular or particular red maple or ruffed grouse that one has found in this landscape that one is walking through. So not just any example that you care to find, but the one that you have found. Notice also that red maple should make us think that we can think about charismatic megaflora as well as charismatic megafauna. I think the second thing that we might say about that passage is that charismatic megaflora and fauna appear in a way that is inextricable from certain landscape and season. So they appear from out of that landscape and season as, in a sense, more given than the rest. But in doing so, they gift their givenness, their excessive givenness, back to the land. So Leopold's phrase, the autumn landscape of the northern woods is experienced is the land plus a red maple plus a red ruffed grouse, where that addition changes the quality of our experience of the land. Okay, so that's one way to think about saturated phenomena and animals. The other way, which I'll just sort of briefly touch on is to think about it in terms of the experience of animals themselves, so from the inside. And here, I'm going to, in a foolhardy way, enter a big debate about what Heidegger means when he says, again famously, animals are poor in world. And, Heidegger speaks at length about his thought that animals are poor in world, but at various points in the lectures where he says so, he says, well, this could actually mean, since I'm talking about something qualitative rather than quantitative, from a certain perspective, it can be thought of as a richness or wealth. And I've given you one of the passages where he says that sort of thing. He says it at several points during these lectures, that we say they're poor in world, but from another perspective, that's a richness or a wealth. So then you think, well, how can it be both? What on earth are you talking about? And one way to think about that, I think, is by thinking that it parallels Marion's understanding of saturated phenomena. So living beings don't structure or cognize their environments as composed of individual objects. They don't structure them as composed of a whole mutually involved set of useful things, or even perhaps as beings in the broadest sense. So what makes a living environment richer, I suggest, than we can imagine, is that it receives an excess of givenness from phenomena. So animals don't relate to beings as such, as Heidegger keeps saying, because their intuition of their environments routinely exceeds their structuring of that environment in the form of their behavioural capacities. So if you think about it in that way, and then hook that up with the thought that Heidegger continually talks about the animal, and a lot of people have a problem with this, suggesting that if you talk about the animal, you're thinking about a sort of homogeneous region of beings where you feel no need to differentiate between them. I think if we think about the animal, as he's talking about it, not as some kind of homogeneous block of animals, but as talking about the sense in which the environments of all individual animals are necessarily and essentially intersected with one another. In doing that, in intersecting with one another, they create a space in which one animal or one particular species, or even the combined behavioural capacities of all of those intersecting living environments, can allow for the appearance of phenomena which is routinely in excess of those particular behavioural structurings of environment. So this is a sort of way of thinking about how it is that Heidegger thinks he can say that animals are both poor in world, and yet at the same time that means that in a certain sense they're excessively rich in world. Okay, so that's the sort of hyper-phenomenality bit of it. So the other side is the hypo-phenomenality bit of it. So less than ordinary experience. So when I summarised Heidegger's reading of Hölderlin's poem, When on a Holiday, I mentioned that Heidegger characterised the wonderful all-present as withdrawing to make way for the appearance of things. So he says, the wonderful withdraws from all producing and nevertheless passes through everything in its presence. Thus, the hyperworld of the holy all-present appears to encompass at one and the same time this notion of less than, kind of hypo world, where the all-present withdraws. The all-present, he says, can be thought of as a region of the open. And this brings us back to what Heidegger feels is a bit lacking in Hölderlin's understanding of nature, or physis, because he thinks that here is thought a kind of withdrawal of being to make a space or the open space in which things can appear. But there's then too much emphasis on that and not enough on the necessary closure or sheltering that goes along with opening a space. And to Heidegger's way of thinking, there's never an opening of a space which isn't at the same time a closure or what he later calls a sheltering being. So as far as Heidegger is concerned, it's very important to think world as opening a space in which things can appear, but we then tend to see that world as completely self-effacing, whereas for him, because the space will always kind of cover something over and cover over its own withdrawal as well, in a sense there's never a completely open region. So Heidegger spends quite a lot of time actually criticizing various people who he thinks think about the open in that way, in particular Rilke. And I think it's more problematic for Rilke than it is for Hölderlin, although I think he thinks that Hölderlin doesn't necessarily get to the heart of the matter either. So what we need to do, according to Heidegger, is to think that there's something like the open, or a kind of space in our experience. We can't experience anything unless there is an open space in which those things can appear. But we need to rethink that idea of an open space to make room for the idea that at the same time, that's never going to be a completely cleared openness region, but something's always going to be closed over at the same time as opened up. So this is how he describes the clearing in a later text, which I think is also on your handout. We can call this openness that grants the possibility of letting appear and show clearing. So the forest clearing, Lichtung, is experienced in contrast to a dense forest called Dichel in our older language. The substantive Lichtung goes back to the verb lichten. The adjective Licht is the same word as light. To lighten something means to make it light, free and open. For example, to make the forest free of trees at one place. The free space thus originating is the clearing. I think it's really interesting, going back to this passage, because I haven't looked at it for a long time, this word Dichung that he uses here, so I'm going to make quite a lot of that word, because as far as I know, it hasn't been sort of picked up on quite as much as it should have been, and probably just because Heidegger immediately goes on to then talk about the clearing or the Lichtung, and it doesn't say a lot more about Dichung. I actually got a big long footnote here about the use of the word Dichung in German forestry terminology, but I won't go into that unless anybody wants to know about it in the questions. So clearing is prior to the appearance of anything in the sense that a space needs to be made for beings to appear, yet that clearing never completely clears away the thickening, the kind of density of being that secludes and preserves the beings that appear within it. So clearing is essentially bound up with thickening, or what we might better call in this context, although I'm not very happy with this word, but anyway, sort of thicketing, like a thicket of a forest, but something that's sort of growing thicker. As such, the priority of clearing is not transcendental, in the sense that I was talking about at the beginning of the talk, because it's not absolutely prior condition of the appearance of phenomena. So things that appear within the clearing can help to maintain the clearing itself. So a little bit like the way that animals in forests, like deer or forest elephants, help to maintain the clearings in the forest and thus maintain their own existence within that forest. They can't appear within the forest unless there are clearings, and it's them that allow the clearings to stay there in the forest. So Heidegger's understanding of clearing, or the kind of open space in which things can appear, is of lightening or freeing up, making a space within the kind of thickening that's always going on, thicketing. So the withdrawal of a hypophenomenal world is essential for things to appear, and yet it's equally essential that such withdrawal is never complete. So my thought is, maybe we can say something more about this thickening or thicketing. And what I'm going to do is to suggest that this idea of Dichon thicketing might be elaborated upon in terms of thinking about the living things that exist as creating spaces or gaps, or what I'm going to call sort of niches of clearing within the thicket. So instead of this kind of overall sense of a clearing needs to be made in the forest, we can think about what's going on within the thicketing as a kind of space in which all living things intersect in their experience, and as they intersect, they create niches of clearing or gaps and holes. So it's that kind of way of thinking that is the final sort of idea of nature that I'm going to talk about, which I'm going to put under this title, mesh. Okay. So as I said, I've borrowed this term from Timothy Morton, who's talking in terms of what he calls the ecological thought, that everything is connected, and he says we should think that kind of connection as what he calls the mesh. Morton talks about the mesh in explicitly anti-phenomenological and specifically anti-Heideggerian terms. He expresses this opposition in characteristically polemical style, in ways which perhaps a little bit imprecise sometimes, but certainly vivid. So this is what he says about Heidegger's contribution to environmentalism. Heidegger's environmentalism is a sad, fascist, stunted bonsai version forced to grow in an iron flower pot by a cottage in the German Black Forest. We can do better. Well, yeah, he gets a bit carried away sometimes. But I think there are some interesting and philosophically more enlightening strands to Morton's critique of Heideggerian environmentalism. And key amongst those is Morton's claim that the ecological thought that everything is connected makes the whole framework of phenomenology that relies upon a difference between foreground and background untenable. So Morton claims, world means a location, a background against which our actions become significant. But in a situation in which everything is potentially significant, we're lost. It's the same situation the schizophrenic finds herself in. She's unable to distinguish between information foreground and noise background. So there's a thought that the ecological thought that everything is connected makes the distinction between a background of significance and the actual coming to appearance of particular significant things or significant actions problematic. That doesn't seem to be exactly right if we take Heidegger's understanding of what world means. For him, everything is already potentially significant. It's just that everything can't manifest all of its significance all at once. So certainly there are various situations that Heidegger describes in which world, you know, the horizon of significance becomes manifest to one extent or another without ceasing to be world. But he also talks about this crucial experience that he calls anxiety, which does seem to bring the world to the fore in a way that deprives it of its significance, or deprives everything of its significance. But I think if we think about that notion of Heidegger's of anxiety, we can see that that's a kind of inverted precursor of what Morton is here calling a schizophrenic experience in which everything is significant, or there's a hyper-significance, a hyper-connectedness of everything. So I don't think Morton's got it exactly right when it comes to talking about what Heidegger means by world, but I think he's certainly onto something when he suggests that the ecological thought, as he's describing it, fundamentally challenges the possibility of thinking about a normal or an everyday experience in which the background can be happily overlooked or ignored. In a sense, ecological crisis is a deep-seated breakdown of the world, where whatever we would want to rely upon as simply working in the background can never be taken for granted. So, it seems to me that in some of Heidegger's later thinking, exactly the thoughts that, something very similar to what Morton is putting forward here, actually sort of find their way into Heidegger's rethinking of what world is. So when he describes later world in terms of a fourfold strife between sky and earth, heaven and earth, and a withdrawal of gods from mortals, that seems to be a rethinking of world where it's not simply an assumed background of potential significance, but in a sense is itself a primordial phenomenon, as he puts it. So this whole idea that Morton has that for phenomenology, world always has to remain as an assumed background, I think is not exactly the case when we come to Heidegger's later thinking of world. But I think we can use Morton's notion of mesh to help us to think about some of the intricacies of what's going on in such a world. And I said specifically that I was trying to think about this notion of thicketing or thickening as a reciprocal condition of clearing. This is what Morton says about mesh in a section of his book called Less is More, Thinking the Mesh. So he says, if everything is interconnected, there's less of everything. Nothing is complete in itself, consider symbiosis. And then he gives us a very long description of various kinds of symbiosis. The ecological thought isn't about a superorganism. Holism maintains that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Nature tends to be holistic. Unlike nature, what the ecological thought is thinking isn't more than the sum of its parts. Taxes are lower for married people because, in a sense, they are there's less of them than two individuals. I'm not quite sure about that. If we want ecology, we will have to trade in nature, with a capital N, for something more meagre. The mesh is made of insubstantial stuff, and its structure is very strange. The more we examine it, the hollower it seems. Gaia is out, harmony is out, and cooperation is in. How am I doing for time?
I'll give you 10 minutes.
Give me 10 minutes, okay.
As long as you want, we started 10 minutes late.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to sort of run you all into the ground, though. Really.
Bring it to completion.
Okay, so I don't think you have to buy into everything in that passage about the concept of nature and holism to see what Morton is getting at when he talks about the mesh in that way, as a kind of multiplicity of hypo-phenomenal niches. And what's important about the mesh is that it's, as I said, full of gaps and holes. In fact, it's composed of the gaps and holes rather than the positive links and relations of a web or a system. So thinking about the mesh in this way, it should be possible to alleviate to some extent some of Morton's concerns, some of Morton's major concerns about Heideggerian environmentalism. In particular, Morton's worried about what he thinks of the foreground-background distinction. He's also worried about Heidegger's emphasis on place, because he thinks that place is a kind of localist and containing notion, as opposed to an expansive and transgressive notion, which he thinks we should be working towards. I think if you have even a sort of cursory look at Heidegger's work on place, especially in some of his later lectures, shows you that it's not quite as straightforward as that, because Heidegger thinks about place as continually constituted by what is out of place or what is not in this place. And he points again towards some of Hölderlin's poetry, where the experience of place is always linked to what is not in this place. And that's why rivers are so important, because of course the place of a river is always constituted by what's not here before me. So this notion of place has no centre, but unlike a kind of modern notion of directionless space, it's cross-cut with multiplicity of directions. So it seems to me that when we start thinking about place in that way, it gets a bit closer, maybe not to the mesh, but to Heidegger's notion of what place means. So we can maybe alleviate some of Morton's concerns about the foreground and the background, and also about the emphasis on locality and place. But I'm not trying to say that Heidegger's already said everything that Morton wanted to say. So I think there's particularly, in Morton's description of the mesh, a very interesting sort of description of the way that living beings constitute and bring about the mesh, as he describes it. And Morton has this quite interesting term. He doesn't like to talk about animals or living beings. So he describes them as strange strangers. So he says, interconnection implies separateness and difference. There would be no mesh if there were no strange strangers. Their mesh isn't a background against which strange strangers appear. It is the entanglement of all strangers. So the entanglement of all strangers is a way of thinking about the enmeshed behavioural and generative capacities of all living things that doesn't reduce them down to a homogeneous region in the way that we do when we say things like animals can do X, or animals can do X and not Y, where we're trying to sort of contain that region of animals are there doing this, or living things are doing this or that. The whole idea that is in being enmeshed in this way, they are continually producing generative and behavioural capacities. And I think Heidegger says some things which might feed into that way of thinking. He describes behaviour in his animal lectures in this way. Eliminative behaviour thus represents the continual production of an emptiness, yet a relation to something like emptiness is only possible where there is a relation to beings as such. So living things are the continual production of an emptiness, which is what allows them to behave and to grow. And they do so, as Heidegger describes it, within these encircling rings of behavioural capacities. They bring about this emptiness, or what I'm calling a kind of niche of clearing, something like that. But according to Heidegger, they can't have a relation to that emptiness itself. They can't, for example, strive after that emptiness or preserve that emptiness, precisely because they don't have a relation to beings as such. Do we have to draw the same conclusion? I think at the very least we should say that, well, if there is a need for something like human beings, for there to be a relation to beings as such, and thus a relation to this production of emptiness in the mesh, that capacity would nevertheless